Hi, everybody. Good evening. Welcome to Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast. Tonight's broadcast is based on a New York Times article called Do You Really See Your Child? That came out just this past Sunday or a Sunday ago. It's based on, it's written by Dr. Daniel Siegel and Dr. Tina Payne Bryson, who it sounds like they have a book coming out on this same topic. Now, I have to admit, this was sent to me, and I feel a little bit like I'm cheating because these topics, this point of tonight is really something I talk about virtually every time we get together for these broadcasts. But I think what's nice, any time you can have two sources to validate the same kind of thing, I think it can be really helpful. So I'm going to talk about it, and I am going to add something to what they wrote about, because I think there's something in their article and in their work that's missing, that's even more foundational than what they're describing. So with that, let's get started. The first idea is that they ask the reader to consider what your child might say some years from now, how they might describe you if you were sitting down to have a coffee with them some years from now. What would they say? Would they say something like the authors say, "My mom, she wasn't perfect, but I always knew she loved me just as I was." Or, "My dad really got me, and he was always in my corner, even when I did something wrong." Do we even see these things as something to aspire to? You know, I'll tell you, when I work with adult clients, and I'm not talking about clients in the context of wilderness therapy, but when I work with adult clients who really get into their work, I cannot tell you how common, how overwhelmingly consistent it is that people tell me that they weren't seen or they were told how they should be or should feel or should think as children. And so this universal, almost ubiquitous experience that children have of not being seen is everywhere. It's just everywhere. It's so common. So we're going to talk about that tonight. Now, I do think for a lot of people, there are a lot of quotes that we see on social media and in the media that talk about the idea of seeing people and holding space for them. And tonight, again, I want to go a little bit deeper and talk about what's the foundation of that ability or that skill. What's the barrier to that ability or skill beneath the behavior? Because like a lot of prescriptive parent education, I think it's important to go beyond telling you what to do. The same exact way that I would describe going beyond what your children should do, how they should behave. Go past the behavior and beneath it. The authors say, or would she end up, that is your daughter, talking about how her parents always wanted her to be something she wasn't, or didn't take the time to really understand her, or wanted her to act in ways that weren't authentic in order to play a particular role in the family or come across a certain way. Now, when you read this quote, I think the vast majority of us would say, that's not the message I'm sending to my child. But I think we might be surprised. I think there are times, like I talked about at the outset, this is my most common thematic message to you all, is seeing your children and about how it builds resilience and esteem, how it really is the soil in which you grow a healthy self. It's attachment. That's really what it is. It's the ability to see the child and to learn to develop a capacity to support them on their journey. So I think a lot of us would probably agree with that. But I think what we don't know is it's the subtle unconscious anxieties that leak, sometimes more than leak. Sometimes we express them overtly. Our frustration, our disappointment, our impatience, our fear. All of those emotions that get into us as we respond to our child, and then we reflect them back to the child. All of those are internalized by the child as something's wrong with them. The idea in attachment is that you take in the child, you metabolize the child or the experience of the child, and then you reflect back a sense of okayness to the child. fundamental, of course, to this is you don't compromise your boundaries. You get more and more clear, authentic, direct, and decisive about your boundaries, but you reflect back a sense that they're okay. They don't have to carry your nonverbal, your unexpressed stress, anxiety. I talk about it this way, that when you feel anxious, upset, frustrated, disappointed, fearful, you in a sense have lost contact with the other. You've lost at least an ability to be a resource in the way that we're describing. I talked about the idea that my experience with adult clients overwhelmingly is this experience of not being seen or heard. I had a friend recently that responded to a post that I shared about children's anxiety, pain, distress, and how it was somebody else's quote, but how that child, the child that is the difficult child, is really the child that's upset, that was never really meant to take care of the person in the first place, right? And my friend responded to it with a kind of a pushback about mother blaming. And as I thought about this, and she invited me to have a discussion with her over coffee and kind of debate it, it's not that I'm blaming the mother. I'm merely pointing out that the child interprets parental angst as a sense of internal badness, right? And sure, children come with, every single child comes with predispositions, medically, physically, genetically. Every child comes with different learning styles. Every child comes with a different temperament. So of course those present objective difficulties in bonding and attachment. Of course they do. But it is the parent's obligation to go and feed themselves, to gather resources, to be able to be there for the child the best that they can. And I'll talk about tonight what the authors talk about in terms of the fact that we can't do it perfectly, we can't do it 100% of the time. Put it another way, the authors say, do our kids feel seen by us? Do they feel truly seen for who they are, not who we'd like them to be, and not filtered through our own fears and desires? I've shared the story many times about Bob Dylan. I grew up loving and admiring Bob Dylan, still to this day I do. And about how when his son had a number one hit album, he was asked by a reporter how he felt about that. And he said it was irrelevant. I was telling that story to a friend recently, or to a client, to the parent of a student. And as I was telling the story, I pointed out how lofty that kind of parenting is. To have so little judgment, in this case, a positive judgment, so little judgment in response to a child's successes or failures. And I mentioned to the person that I was talking with that Bob Dylan, a couple of years ago, some of you might know, was awarded the Nobel Prize. That's interesting, but what's utterly fascinating about that is he didn't pick it up. He was unavailable to receive the award. And I was just saying to this person, that's a different kind of quality, right? A different kind of person. I think most of us, if we won a Nobel Prize, would probably show up. But to Bob, it didn't matter. It was irrelevant. So in a way, Bob was teaching us by those two incidences that are really 25 years apart, the two stories that I'm telling you, one toward his son and having no judgment, and one placing no value on an award given by a committee. He had healed. He had come to a sense of himself, so much so that he could reflect back to his child a sense of adequacy or okayness, a sense that the child was okay and good enough. They talk about, now this is one of my soapboxes. They call it hyper-parenting, synonymous with helicopter parenting. And they talk about this idea that not only is it prevalent in our society, especially among the affluent, but it's something to aspire to, right? Providing children, they mentioned something about Mandarin lessons in preschool, right? Horse riding lessons in the afternoons, all kinds of extracurricular, having a incredibly enriched childhood. Again, this is where I make a distinction that the authors don't, at least in this article. It's not about whether or not you do those things. It's really not. It's about where they come from. See, just like we talk about with your children, it's not about the behavior, but it's about what's underneath it, what's at the root that's important to focus on. It's the same with parents. But what this hyper-parenting, this helicopter parenting often signals is really parental anxiety, a lack of a sense of self. And so we work it out through our children. Their successes become our successes. They become a reflection of us. They, in essence, become a measure. Their success becomes a measure of our worth. Our guilt, our fear, our anxiety are present, and we do all these things to try to cover it up or compensate for it. That really is the issue. Helicopter parenting as a behavior is not the problem. It's not deep enough. The description, at least the title, is not. It's a behavioral description. It's really what's underneath. And if it comes from a place of the parent's needs, really, that's what it is. It's the difference between attending to your needs or seeing the child and what their needs are and learning to respond to them. That's why I say all the time that overindulging children doesn't create narcissism. Permissive parenting doesn't create narcissism, at least not behaviorally speaking. What creates narcissism is a lack of being seen or being valued for the wrong things, for your accomplishments or successes or talents. They talk about this idea that it's a problem with the affluent. I borrowed from Madeline Levine's book that talks about how wealth and is really about opportunity, not necessarily about money. So do we have enough money, enough resources to give our children lots of opportunity? She talks about that in The Price of Privilege. I thought this was an interesting comment in the article a couple of Sundays ago. They said, not only is hyper-parenting or helicopter parenting or snowplow parenting, over-functioning parenting, not only is it exhausting for the parents, because of the pressure that they feel, it may not be best for the child. And I picked that sentence apart, and I've highlighted it on the screen for those of you watching. And I'm thinking the pressure they feel, you know, the pressure they feel gets transferred directly to the child. And think about how much more capable you are, how much more resilient and resourceful you are as an adult than your children. So if it's pressure for you, that gets transferred unconsciously to the child. I will say this as clearly as I can. Children will be inclined, will feel the pull at least, the need, the ask to take care of the parent at the cost of their authentic self. That's the risk, that's the danger. It's a survival instinct in the child. If I become too much of a burden, I'm going to be left. And human babies are not very resilient. Human babies, more than virtually most any species on the planet, need to stay with their parents longer to survive. So if you become a pain to your parents, you risk death. So it's a survival instinct to take care of, to not be too much of a problem. I've been reading the book East of Eden when I can, in between all of the reading I do for work recently. And they talk about this idea about how we seek out this need to take care of our parents. Two of the main characters that were abandoned by their mother as young children, when they discover that their mother might be alive, ask each other the question, do you think she didn't like us? Do you think we were too hard? Do you think we were a burden? It is the child's wiring to believe that the mother and father's smile and frown is an indication of their badness or goodness. That is why it is incumbent on us to take care of ourselves. And you showing up here tonight is one way to do that. And of course, it may not be best for the child. It runs counter to all we know about child development and psychology. By the way, I can't tell you how often I hear from renowned psychologists and therapists and programs all over the world. I was just consulting with a family recently where they had a child on another continent. And the letter that they were encouraged to write to their young adult child was absolutely abusive. There was virtually nothing in it that was appropriate from a developmentally informed perspective. So what does it mean? They talk about this idea, the authors, of showing up. That's really what your children need, is for you to show up. And they start that off by describing it as to bring your whole being to the child. Now, I can't think of a taller order than bringing your whole being to the child. First of all, you have to have a whole being or somewhat, you know, something closely approximating a whole being. That's our life's work, isn't it? That's virtually what we're working on for the rest of our life, is to discover who we are, to show up as we are. So you're obviously going to fail at that or fall short of perfection, but that becomes the project, right? That becomes your focus. And the wonderful thing about that becoming your focus is if that becomes your focus and your angst is directed at self and developing a more integrated whole sense of yourself, then your child doesn't have to be the identified patient, right? How nice is it that you now, along with them, are an identified patient? You can't do it all the time. Nobody can do it perfectly, nowhere close. So what are you supposed to do? And what they say is make repairs, right? Make repairs when you fail. Maybe the simplest, earliest skill that I try to teach parents is say you're sorry. It doesn't matter if you're only 2% of the problem. Apologize for that. Besides, your 2% weighs disproportionately upon the shoulders of your child, meaning that you occupy a different space. And they're numbskulls, right? They're half brain, not fully formulated brain numbskulls. That's who they are, with learning differences and diagnoses and temperament that gets in the way. That's their deal. But you and me, we're imperfect also. So we learn to apologize. And we learn that our apologies aren't for our boundaries. They're for our leakage. They're for our mistakes. And we're not apologizing for their issues. We're not apologizing in the context of cause and effect. What I'm going to say to my friend and colleague when we have this sit down over coffee about blaming mothers, I'm going to say it's not about blaming the mother for the child's behavior. It's about holding the mother becoming accountable, or father, for her response to the child's behavior. And there's no right or wrong. And by the way, when you have a child with learning differences, when you have a child with difficult temperament, when you have a child with mental health and addiction, when you have children with those, you're going to be stressed and taxed. That's a fact. So if you get overwhelmed and leak onto your child and they internalize it as something's wrong with them, what are you going to do about that? You're going to apologize, and then you're going to go back to work, right? They talk about showing up, bringing your whole self, meaning being present with your children and seeing them. All of this is kind of symbolic language of a healthy attachment. is the best predictor of how a child turns out. Now, I put a link on the screen for those of you that are watching. For those of you that aren't watching, you can simply Google my name, Brad Reedy and Jeff Larson and Family Mediator. Because 20 years ago, we talked about this idea that the most powerful mitigating factor in families against trauma is having and identifying the child, identifying that one person saw them. Guys, let me say this as emphatically as it deserves to be said. We don't know anything. And by the way, Daniel Siegel is an MD. He studies brain science. He's not a therapist. So you want the hard data, it's there. He talks about, in all of his books, hard science. He talks about attachment and how it affects the brain of the parent and the child. But let me say this. We don't know anything more impactful on the healthy development of a child than a parent's ability to respond to that child with healthy attachment responses. Calmness, curiosity, patience, compassion, non-judgment, love. We don't know anything. And the number one predictor of a parent's ability to do that is the amount of work that they do. Not the quality of their upbringing or their childhood. Having a quote-unquote good childhood is an excuse not to do your work. It is to unravel and uncover the unique history of your childhood that makes you capable. It's the number one predictor that makes you capable of providing this kind of show-up experience that the authors are talking about. They describe the four S's of showing up. Being safe, where children feel protected and sheltered from harm. Being seen, where the children know that you care about them and you pay attention to them as they really are, not as you want them to be or as they should be, but as they are. Being soothed, where you know you'll be there for them, they'll know that you'll be there for them when they're hurting. And finally, secure, which develops from the other above S's, so they trust you to predictably help them feel at home in the world. Right? This is all secure attachment stuff. This is all attachment stuff. And they identify that the safe, many parents, most parents can do that for the children. Soothe, many parents can do that also. But the seen is often the missing equation. And I agree. That's why it's our practice, it's our experience, it's our education that teaches parents to listen to children. And when parents often, not always, not even a majority of the time, but often it comes up where they'll say, I do listen to my child. And after a few weeks of deeper study, they come to realize that they haven't really listened anywhere near as well as they thought they had. You know, there are the cliches about the dad that wants the kid to kick a soccer ball into a net, or the mom that wants the kid to get straight A's, right? The parents that want the daughter to be a professional dancer or play the piano like a master. There are all those kinds of cliche examples. I remember I had a father 20-some years ago sitting in a session with his son, kind of contradicting his son's idea that the dad wasn't really there for him, saying, you know, I was always at your sporting events. I always wanted to play catch. I was your coach in Little League. And the boy calmly said, patiently said to his father, I didn't really like sports. I liked art. But you couldn't really see that. So there are those kind of outward cliche examples of not seeing your children. But there are things that are much more subtle. I was telling this to somebody this morning. I've learned how to show up for other people because I've done some healing with where I was not seen. Right? Because I've learned what it means to be seen and not be seen in my own life, I now know what it is to be a friend and a father and a spouse more than I would have ever known had I not unraveled that. And had I not, you know, even going farther, had I not struggled with anxiety at times, depression at times. Right? So part of this quality that the authors and I are suggesting is something worthy of our aspiration, part of this quality often comes when we realize what we need. And when we're hurting, what do we need somebody to say? The problem is that a lot of us think that because this is the way that our parents do it, that a good, quick, swift kick in the butt will be helpful. So we believing that. We know no other way. And I don't know that we can ever discover the other way until we experience it. It wasn't until years into my therapy I figured out what was happening, what was different. What does it mean to see somebody? It means to manage your own and contain your own distress and to sort that out somewhere else and to be them for all the ways that you possibly can within your comfort to be there to support them. And your comfort zone, your ability to support will increase and increase over time. It's not to control them. It's not to sculpt them. They're not our masterpieces to create, right? They are ours to have the honor of witnessing them unfold. You know, watching my four children, incredibly different talents and struggles and weaknesses and gifts. And there's no way, not even close, that the same style of parenting will work for each one of them. If I were looking at kind of the superficial style. But if my attention is deeper, and that is bringing my whole self to them, learning to see them, meet them where they're at, and support them where they need to go, that style works with everybody because it's, by definition, tailor-made. This is where it always gets interesting to me. This was not in the article. It may be in the book that's coming out, but it was not in the article. What are the barriers? Why don't we provide a healthy attachment experience for our children? Our feelings, our fears and anxiety, right? Like from the Star Wars saga, that is what leads to the dark side, is our fear. Our lenses, the shoulds and shouldn'ts that we've interjected, that we've adopted, that we've been passed down, that have been passed down to us from previous generations about the way people should be. I think I said to you recently that I have a client that every once in a while, right before she tells me this big, powerful truth, she'll say to me almost always, "I know I shouldn't say this." And every time she says that, I get really excited because I think something honest is coming, something important and valuable is coming. Our hopes and ideas, right? What we expect. And part of the job of the symptom, the diagnosis that our children are struggling with, part of its job, its duty, is to tear down our hopes and expectations about things. Because that's a too heavy of a saddle to be saddled with for a child. The authors say in the article, even in our most well-meaning moments, we can fall into the trap of hoping our kids will be something other than who they really are. I think it's an interesting statement, but I don't agree with well-meaning moments in one way. The intention is to manage our anxiety. You see, that's the deepest message. People say, well, they had good intentions. They were well-meaning. No. They were just trying to take care of their own anxiety and fears. That's the meaning. That's the intention. So when we do this work and we strip down a few layers, we get rid of this idea, this ego idea of being a good parent. We really do. We get rid of this ego idea of being a good person. We just say, sometimes I get scared, and when I get scared, I can reduce myself to a controlling, manipulative. Of course, I'm going to frame it under the guise, the umbrella of love, which makes it much more insidious, right? The insidiousness, even of this quote, is the phrase well-meaning. We abuse our children inadvertently, all of us, me first. We mistreat our children, me first. We mistreat our children. And what makes it insidious is we call it love or good intent. And it's not. Neither is it bad intent, by the way. I haven't said that either. It's just fear. That's what I love about therapy and psychology is we tear it away from this kind of moral, judgmental matrix. And we just look at it for what it is. It's fear. It's pain. It's grief. It's powerlessness. It's sadness. That's what it is. And like Cahil Gibran says in his fantastic poem, On Good and Evil, I can't, he says, of the goodness in you I can speak, but not of the evil. For what is evil but that which is tortured by its own thirst? Because when evil is starving, it will go into dark caves and drink of poisoned waters, something along that line. That's the difference. That's the wonderful thing about mental health is we take out the judgments, but the fear of taking out the judgments is that's the only way we knew. That's how we were told to stay within the lines, right? And there's some people on this podcast tonight. I'm looking at the names. I know some of you. Some of you just stumble into this program of Evoke, our parent support groups, our intensives, our parent workshops, the podcasts, the books that we talk about. And you start to tear down the walls. You start to tear down the things that were built that you were told would keep you safe and make you happy. And it's terrifying and uncomfortable and painful. But on the other side of that reconstruction is a self. The most beautiful, most delicate, most resilient thing on the planet. Self. So yes, sometimes it's sports and grades and gender norms. Those are our hopes and expectations, but more commonly it's feelings, thoughts, and ideas. The great enigmatic painter, artist, he talks about this idea, Banksy talks about this idea that parents will let their children do anything except for be themselves sometimes. I'm not blaming. I'm not coming down on you. It's just what we do. It's okay. I raise my hand first. And I study this stuff every day, all day. I woke up an hour before I was supposed to this morning because I wanted to add a quote to my book. That's how much I think about it. That's how I do this. And I still bumble and stumble around. I still make mistakes in all the areas that I teach you about. All the time. The authors say seeing our kids also means being willing to look beyond our initial assumptions and interpretations. Rather than immediately correcting manners, you should first observe where she is right now. And work to understand the feelings behind the behavior. It's remaining curious. That's actually so much like the chapter epigraph of my first book on behavioral change. Before we change a behavior, and here they say before we look at manners and start to make interpretations, before we try to change the behavior, we would be wise to spend some time listening to what the behavior is trying to tell us. Asking ourselves, the question, I wonder why he did that. So the foundation of seeing is self. Helicopter parenting, anxious parenting, over-involved parenting, snowplow parenting is not too much love. It's not enough self. To do that, you've got to unravel your history. You've got to look back. You've got to challenge the things that you were taught. Tear them apart and look at them and see if they belong. You've got to be willing to do some battle with guilt and shame. Your guilt and shame for your failures. For recognizing that you dent your children, for example. We all do. You've got to find a container, a therapist, a place where you can vent, where you can refuel. Eventually, you've got to, you do that so you can contain yourself. That's really what containing is I'm going to contain my reaction. It's not about repression. It's about right now I can be there for you. My wife will share with me some upset thoughts and she'll say, what are you thinking? And my answer is, not now. I just want to listen. I just want to understand. We'll sort out what's going on with me later. Of course, sometimes I'm stupid enough to blurt out what I'm thinking, and I think you all know how that goes. To understand the difference between give and take, I talk about this in my new book. To understand when you're giving and when you're taking, and I think in relationships, we're pretty confused about that. We think when we're sharing or giving, more often you're taking, you're asking to be contained. And containing takes capacity. When I do my job as a therapist with your children, with you, with the clients that I have, at the meetings that I attend, it takes physical energy. It takes caloric energy to hold space for you, right? I have to sit with your pain, not solve it, not fix it. And sitting with pain and distress and hopelessness and powerlessness and fear and worry and angst, that's not easy to do. So it's the listener who's doing the giving and the sharer who's doing the taking. When we ask our partner or our child to share, that might not be what they need. We might be expressing our need. Those are just a couple of examples of getting clear about give and take and intimacy. And then we have to have a full belly. We have to have a full emotional belly because you cannot draw water from an empty well. So you have to have resources, and you wouldn't be here if your children weren't struggling. Those of you that are attending this live, those of you that are listening can probably relate also. You have to fill yourself up, which means you have to do battle with guilt because you have to take self-care and neglect other people. There was a great quote that I read today in the East of Eden. I wrote it down. The servant to one of the main characters said to him as he was asking to take his leave and to go live his own life, he said, "Try not to need me. That's the worst temptation for a lonely man. Try not to need me. That's the worst temptation to a lonely man." So we learn to take care of ourselves so that when we show up to our children, it's not our needs that are being attended to, being expressed. What are the take-homes? You have to understand attachment. What is it? What does it look like? We have a podcast on attachment. Go to it. There's a chapter in my new book that talks about attachment responses. Buy it. Read it. You have to first have to understand and unravel your own attachment history. It's virtually impossible, or you're going to be at a significant disadvantage if you don't do that. And remember that in parenting education, what you do with your children is a signal of your unfinished work, or your finished work for that matter. But you know, it's not what you do to your children. It's not the decision that you make. Those are just signals that signal some evidence of what might be going on underneath, like fear, anxiety, pain, loneliness, poor self-worth, or strength, love, capacity, wholeness. Manage your feelings, because they're yours. You manage your feelings. And also manage your boundaries. They're also yours. And just remembering that it takes great capacity and great strength. So pass in your live questions. I'm going to go over some of the upcoming information. I have I have my new book cover draft to share with you if you haven't seen it yet. I will be in New York City on Monday, January 27th at 7 p.m. And I'll be in Southern California in North Hollywood on Sunday, April 5th at 4 to 7 p.m. to get in and stay on the list for parent support groups, invites to RSVP, to ask for more information, email Kaysha, K-A-Y-S-H-A, at evoketherapy.com. If you are a current parent, we ask all current parents to come to one workshop. The next one is January 25th in Southern Utah. Following that is February 15th. Again, RSVP to Kaysha at evoketherapy.com for more information or to confirm your reservation. K-A-Y-S-H-A, Kaysha at evoketherapy.com. If you want to do a deeper dive, again, based on everything I've said tonight, you want to equip yourself to be able to do this, come to Finding You. They're filling up fast. The next Finding You is February 19th. I'm also going to be in England in May. That will fill up in advance. And then we're going to have Finding You 2. We're probably going to have to add a couple of dates because these are filling up swiftly also. April 16th and July 15th if you've been to a Finding You. Go to our website. Email us at intensives@evoketherapy.com for questions or call our admission staff. Pursuit trips are trips all around the world. Think sober fun or therapy light. We ask all current parents to go to 6 12-step support groups, any combination of Al-Anon, CODA, or Families Anonymous. Also, adultchildren.org is great if you had a childhood that was difficult. Alateen is for teens. Refuge Recovery is for people who might not want such an emphasis on a higher power. It's Buddhist-inspired. And then the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI.org, is a place to go get free resources and classes in your area. All of these broadcasts are available on the podcast app, on your iPhone or iOS device using the podcast app, on an Android device using the SoundCloud app, or on your computer, go to soundcloud.com. On Twitter and Instagram, find Evoke Therapy using the handle @EvokeTherapy. Or if you want to find our intensives page on Instagram, use Evoke Therapy Intensives as the handle. On Facebook, you can find us by searching Evoke Therapy Programs or the Alumni Foundation. You can search on Facebook by searching Evoke Therapy Foundation. Also, our blog has new content each week. You can find my first book, The Journey of the Heroic Parent, and coming soon, you can find my upcoming book, The Audacity to Be You, Learning to Love Your Horrible Rotten Self, which will also be available on Amazon. And you see a draft of the cover right there. We're still going to tweak that a little bit. It'll be out in the next few weeks. You can go to the Amazon Smiles program and use the Parent Alumni Foundation book page there and the Evoke Family Foundation page there to buy books, and all a percentage of the proceeds goes to help people who can't afford treatment. All right. Any comments or questions? I have one comment that's come in so far. It says, thank you for sharing your message with compassion and humility. It's easy to put up defenses when if we are afraid we are doing it wrong, but you always remind us not to judge ourselves. I was talking to a parent recently about the mistakes that they made, and you've probably heard me say this, and let's just assume that you're the worst parent in the world. What should we do to you? Should we execute you? You know, at the end of the day, okay, I'm a slob. Now what? I can beat myself up and give up, or I can pick myself up and try again. So I am with you. Another parent says, I often struggle to find the balance in energy, time, and my capacity to show up or take care of me, find my container, and contain myself. Let me make a comment about that. I think I shared this with you a couple of weeks ago. I had a therapist on my therapist training call ask me where you draw that line between your boundary, right, where you get to the edge of your energy and your compassion. And she said, how do you find that line? Where is it? And I just said to her, you're right. That's the right question. Just like your comment, it's the right struggle to have. You work on that for the rest of your life. You work on doing what you can do until you can't do it. And then you retreat to your places of support, your resources, your self-care to fill your tank, and then you come back. And you get to decide where the line is. It doesn't make you a good or a bad parent if you have more or less capacity. I want to say this. It doesn't make you a good or a bad parent or a good or a bad spouse or a good or a bad friend, no matter what anybody tells you. It doesn't make you a good or a bad one depending upon where you draw your line. if your capacity wanes, if you get to the edge of your capacity, all it tells you is that you've reached the edge of your capacity. Do you see the difference? But because we think in good and bad so much, because we think, I struggle with this today, that if to be a good husband, to be a good dad, I need to give more. I give what I give until I can't give. Then I need to get. That's kind of the deal. So yeah, that's the right struggle. That's the life's work. That's our work. All right, folks, I don't have a topic. That looks like all the questions and comments. I don't have a topic for next week, but the next broadcast will be Tuesday evening, January 21st, at 7 p.m. Mountain Time. So I look forward to that. As I say, always, you've tolerated this broadcast. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for and on behalf of your children. I am with you. You are not alone. You are not the only one going through this. You are just one of the few who are willing to admit that you're going through it. So thank you for the courage and the heroic effort that it takes to look inward, to look at yourself. Thanks for joining this evening, either live or on the podcast app. Have a great day, great evening. Take care. Bye-bye.